Welcome to Care in Action, the podcast by Care Austria, with Andrea Barstorff-Hager.
A very warm welcome to Care in Action. Today's guest is Achana Prasad, a visionary creative technologist and researcher at the Royal College of Art. Achana is at the forefront of making AI more equitable and inclusive. She also joined us as a juror for the first AI for Social Impact initiative, a collaboration between Care Austria and Ars Electronica that spotlights AI projects driving real social and humanitarian change. Achana, a very good morning and welcome to our show.
Good morning, Andrea. Thanks for having me. It's lovely to be here.
It's our pleasure. And as I already mentioned in your introduction, we recently sat together on this jury for the first AI for Social Impact Award. And we went together through many, many submissions. So from your perspective, Achana, what did you think when you screened the applications for this award?
Oh, no, I was thrilled, to be honest. We need more such kinds of platforms that bring to the fore where artistic practices meet technology and impact focus. And so I think that particular session was just very heartwarming, very hope-inducing. We saw, Andrea, as you'd remember, we saw some incredible projects. It was, in fact, almost too hard to choose. I feel like there was certainly something fabulous in the fact that, you know, all of these different organizations, individuals, collectives were coming together and looking at some of these urgent and pressing issues through their practice. It was great.
I mean, it was also my impression that there is a certain problem to connect technology researchers, especially from outside Europe, to large NGOs like CARE. This was the impression that I gained when I was invited to be at the Stats Prize jury, particularly for Africa. And you also mentioned there are not enough platforms for that, which sounds rather surprisingly, because one wouldn't assume it's not so difficult to get in touch with each other, right?
Yeah, but I think we all have our particular silos that we fall into, right? Like in our daily lives and our professional lives. And some of these issues are complex, they're hard, and you go quite deep. If you were an artist, you can go very deep into your practice and not encounter technology more carefully or more closely. And so I think through this process of or these kinds of platforms that CARE and Ars brought together, I think we start encouraging people to reach across these kinds of silos and borders, you know. And it's not just borders of whether it's technology and arts and impact, it's also across borders of geography and politics. Mm-hmm. And we need to see more of that. And I think that these awards and sessions really encourage that and put these out there into the world, you know.
You're absolutely right. And as a leader of a large organization, which is part of a global confederation, I can also assure you that we try to be open-minded and welcoming. But of course, we have to deal with so many things on a daily business that maybe we are also not as easy to access as we assume that we are. And this is why CARE Austria initiated that exercise.
Yeah, well done, you guys.
So before we take a deeper dive into what you're doing professionally, I would really love to hear a little bit how it came that you became a technologist and researcher. What did motivate you as a child? When did you decide this is what I want to do? Let us hear a little bit how it came that you became a technologist.
Okay, this might date me a little bit, but I think when I was...
We have around, time in this podcast a little bit.
When I was around 9 or 10, my father, who is very interested in these kinds of new technologies, he's not a technologist, you know, but he's just interested as a consumer, and he bought the first computer, in fact, in our neighborhood even. I think I was the first one to have that. I lived in India, in Bangalore, south of India. It's now, this city is now considered one of the main technology cities in the world even. But at the time, we were just a small town, very research focused. So, you know, you had the Indian Institute of Science, you had the Aeronautics Development Institute, so a lot of, you know, large research bodies. And then my dad brought in this computer, and it was a magical device for me. And I remember spending a couple of days just on the paint tool. It was a Windows machine, and I was just like, oh my God, like, this is crazy, you know. And I think that early kind of engagement with that, but always, as I think, since I was a child, I've been kind of always leaning into the arts. And so kind of exploring the technology, but through paint and, you know, pushing that, I think that stayed with me for my whole life, really. And so it was very exciting when I finished design school, my second master's there in animation. And so I've just been in the arts world all along, right? I did painting, I did a master's in art history. And then I kind of very serendipitously, actually, through doing a show where I was exploring visual editing and performance, visual video performance, I was invited into Microsoft Research that had just begun to get set up in Bangalore. So I think I was maybe number 5 or 6 in their cohort of people that they employed. It was incredible to see. I think the leadership there was really looking at a very multidisciplinary approach. So you had the brightest minds from ethnography, economy, you know, just different fields all being kind of brought there with one focus. How can we use technology to better the society around us in India, which was at that time, and even now, I think, struggling, a large portion, a majority portion, struggling with base issues, basic issues of, you know, livelihood and just surviving. And so, you know, so that really kind of cemented my interest in this idea of how to, and me as an artist in that lab, I think I saw this great power, you know, to kind of bring perspectives that the technologists or the economists or the computer scientists, they weren't seeing it the way I was seeing it. And I was seeing it from how people felt, you know, from their stomachs, and, you know, so like I was seeing it from a very kind of emotive, emotional, empathetic kind of pathway, and I was able to communicate that. And so I saw myself as a bridge between these worlds, and I was able to talk to all of these different perspectives. As an artist, that's a kind of a superpower you come equipped with. You're able to kind of understand and, you know, process and then kind of bring together different perspectives in new and interesting ways. And that's what I think the lab gave me, surprisingly, you know. I mean, Microsoft in those days was, and maybe even now to a small extent, was kind of the wicked, wicked organization. It's a strange world that we live in now, that it's really one of the better ones perhaps today. But yeah, you kind of, it brought me to that, and I set up my own organization, not for profit, in Bangalore called Jaga, with my co-founder Freeman, where we really explored that, like, how do we create a space that enables people who are not mainstream technologists, who want to go beyond that, to use that practice in ways that impact society. Look at the UN SDG goals, right? Like, so what are those? Can we bring those people together? Because that just wasn't available as a physical space. And we thought that just people encountering each other, that serendipity of those conversations, might itself spark ideas. And it did. And we still run that organization today. We started in 2009, and it's still very much doing this kind of, you know, bringing together. And yeah, sorry, I can go on, but I'm aware of that.
We will go on. Let me just summarize a bit. No, because it's really interesting. So your first interest was art, and when you discovered technology, then it opened up a new variety of powerful tools, right? What you can do with these tools, what you can achieve, also from an artistic perspective.
Yeah, and I think I have a bit of a hacker in me, right? Like I wanted always to push the tools. Like it wasn't enough the way it was given to me. It was always like, but what if we could do that and then that other thing as well? And that comes from conversations. It comes from conversations with people from very different backgrounds, economic backgrounds, cultural backgrounds. You have a lot of these conversations and these ideas start coming into your mind, and then you find that the tools are not enough. And
But
that's what, no.
the human dimension is key still, right?
Oh
And
my
it will
gosh,
stay
absolutely.
key for also for the near future.
I would say that. I would say it's not just key, it's critical. I think it's the most important part of making a future that's worth having.
And worth living together as civil society, as a global civil society, right? So
Absolutely.
you work at an intersection of art and technology and civil society, right?
Very much so, yes.
Very much
Yeah.
so. And I understood, as in many cases, and we had this in many conversations in this podcast, but not only, that the father was really the initial spark to many daughters. Fathers are the initial spark for their interests and how they live their interests and what sort of education they get. This is really an interesting phenomenon. I hear that
Hold
very,
on.
very often.
Hold on.
Yeah.
I didn't actually tell you how important my mother and my grandmother and aunt
So
were. Like
please
they
let
were
us know that.
critical. So my grandmother was an entrepreneur. She was not literate, but she was able to set up a wonderful store that still runs close to 100 years ago now. And she did that where she made the connection between urban women and how the sari that they wore could be made by rural artisans. And so she kind of became a bridge between these two and would work very closely with these artisans. My mother continued that, but my mother, my grandmother, my aunt, these three women were incredibly powerful role models. They came from very much a cultural background. They were patrons of the arts. They encouraged me to explore performance arts and visual arts. You know, they really fought for me to have those kinds of art-related experiences, which I feel incredibly lucky for. And because we were a multi-generational family, I lived in my grandparents' house. My parents lived with their parents. I was able to lived through a lot of cultural practices rooted in the religion, perhaps, but still we always looked at them as transferring kind of cultural traditions, whether that be the saris we wore, the jewelry we wore, or whether the food we prepared or the events we hosted. And I think that has really stayed. I grew up in a very open household that brought together these kinds of intellectuals and artists, and you know, they were always around me. And so this kind of constant, I guess, mix of that. And then because we lived very close to the Indian Institute of Science and a lot of my family were engaged in the sciences, you had like, you know, uncles and aunts who were either musicians or dancers or artists, and uncles and aunts who were like scientists and bankers. And so you had a very interesting constant, you know, exposure. And I see what a privilege that was. You
This
know, what an
sounds super
incredible.
inspiring, even from listening to it. You must have had a really nice childhood.
I
And
do.
no, which is good to have a good start in life and to really make something out of own life. Let's talk a little bit now about generative AI and how to make it more accessible. And also this new platform that Care Austria and Ars Electronica established is there to explore how we can apply AI-driven tools with minimum of barriers or best no barriers, keeping data security and make it more accessible. I mean, we are talking now about global project implementation. Even in Europe, it is not super accessible for everybody. I don't want to create the idea that in so-called northern countries, this is already done and everything is flying. We are also struggling with it. So how can we ensure that we do the right things for civil society and that we engage them in rights-based ways. I think you have many ideas about that.
Oh yeah, a lot. First off, I think what CARE is doing is amazing. What ours is doing is amazing. Just as organizations, they function almost like hubs or consortiums, or, you know, they're convening across geographical borders and practice borders. And, you know, so I think that that itself is an incredibly important thing in our construct in the world we live in now, where we're, you know, where these borders are coming up really strongly and in ways that are not useful at all. In fact, detrimental to our progress as a planetary whole, right? Like civil society, but as a planetary civil society, more than human societies even, right? I think that's incredibly important. When we think of technology, I mean, so I wear this hat of being a co-founder of GUI.ai, and, you know, we're really looking at ourselves as a research lab that enables organizations, impact organizations in particular, to build very unique, let's say, unique technology solutions in the AI space, but with care, with these ethics in mind, with these policies in mind, with a better future in mind. So how do we do that? First, we have to do it together. There is no proprietary way. So we are, just eminent. The DPG status is very eminent right now. So, you know, the whole open source process. We as a platform, we want to be open source. We want to use only the open source technologies under us. So that's something that I think we all really need to keep an eye on.
Mm-hmm. I think that means highly accessible, not super regulated, and everybody can tap into it for non-technicians, right?
Yeah.
And low coding.
Yes. So our platform is definitely low code, no code. In fact, right now we've just launched our vibe code. So which enables people who are not literate to also just speak, their intent and then have that come back to them, as a solution or a product or a piece of content. But that has to go hand in hand. So this kind of inclusive practice, I think we're really at a very exciting time with the technologies that are emerging today to include people that have never been included in this digital world, right? When I think of communities, these weavers that my grandmother, you know, works with, my mother mm-hmm. continues to work with, they are not directly benefiting from several of these digital technologies. They're at best downstream users, right? There are people who have never encountered any kind of digital tool or even service. So I feel like now, because of these, you know, like 11 Labs does this fantastic job of text-to-voice translations. It's based here in Europe. And these kinds of technologies and organizations are building the possibility to include people that we were not able to or willing to include. So that's important. But there's also a lot of responsibility that comes with bringing different people to the table, whether that's all of us trying to understand what is the state of art of AI? What is the state of politic of AI? What does it mean ecologically? What does it mean in terms of power hierarchies? Who benefits and who is exploited? What is exploited? What is left out? I think these are all conversations that, interestingly enough, Andrea, like it's a level playing field. You can be a academic in a fantastic, you know, prestigious place like Royal College, where I'm at. You can be, a farmer in rural India. You can be a tradesman in Europe. We're all grappling with the same learning curve.
That's a super interesting phenomenon, because I have been working in humanitarian and development field. It's tough to say it, but it's over 35 years. And the older I get, the more experience I get, the more I have the feeling that we are talking about the same things. There's not such a big division like it was 20, 30 years ago anymore. And as you framed it so nicely, Archana, we exactly grapple with the same things, and we have to make sure that we are inclusive in using these powerful technology if we don't want our own civil society to break apart somehow. And this is not the only field of science. Technology by far is not the only field of science where we see this risk, but I think it is a strong promoter of speeding up things, where we really have to be cautious that everybody has a seat, or as many as possible, and are willing to have a seat around the table. And from my way I see it, I always share also with my colleagues that if care is not speeding up itself on making useful use of these powerful tools, it might add to becoming more and more irrelevant in the future, because I have to subjective impression that there is a big demand out there in the world for, in this case, really not being left totally out like it happened in many other cases.
No, absolutely. And so we have this moment, it's a window in time, I think, where, and there have been moments like this, right? Like we saw mm-hmm. that in the Industrial Revolution, and everyone likes to compare the Industrial Revolution to what is happening today. I think what is happening today is far more profound.
When and faster.
And faster. It's incredibly fast. Mm-hmm. And we want to learn from those histories. We don't want to repeat those. Women have been left out. Rural communities have been left mm-hmm. out. Several countries have been left out mm-hmm. of these kinds of means of progress, right? So we certainly have the possibility today to address that and correct that. However, the way it's come out, and I'm talking primarily around AI technologies, the way it's hit ground is way lesser than good. You know, it's just not ideal. And there are many, many reasons why, and very good reasons why we are angry as an arts community. We've been exploited. Why we're angry as an impact community. Our data has been taken but used for wrong reasons. There are many fantastic reasons for us to be angry, but I don't think this is the moment for us to disengage. In fact, what you're saying is absolutely right, Andrea. We have to not just engage and critique, we have to engage and dive in and work, you know, roll up our sleeves, work with these technologies and break them and change them from inside.
There is
a growing wave of people like us who are thinking like this. And that is also very hope-inducing in the sense that, you know, you're thinking like this from CARE. I'm thinking like this as an artist from RCA and a co-founder of, you know, a tech platform. And Ars Electronica is thinking of it as a platform that brings together people. I feel like there are more and more people realizing this urgency from academia, from industry, from impact sector, development sector, and government also, yeah. Right? And so this is really good.
I don't come from a technology background. I only apply modern technologies in the fields of work that I have to deal with. But I think this is exactly what this AI for Social Impact Award is about, to bring people together and to, in my words, I would say, we customize the highly criticized technology that comes from the big American tech players. There is a lot one could say about that, but in the end, the products are very interesting and super powerful, and they are getting customized now on a global level. And what we are doing should help customize them for the benefits of civil society. I'm intentionally not talking about human-centered AI because it is really somehow a buzzword. Maybe Archana, you can explain to our audience from your point of view why we should avoid to talk about this buzzword that was used by everybody. Let's do human-centered AI. Can you explain a little bit about that?
I'll take it this way, right? I think I'm going to continue what you were asking and opening up in your previous question and tie it into this. Human-centered is surely important, but we are at a planetary moment. This means we have to think about our ecologies. We have to think about the earth, the sky, the water. We have to think about every living creature. We have to think about the plants. And so we are in a position of great responsibility right now. And so this human-centered feels a little more exclusive of this larger planetary kind of mission that we're all on. I'll put it this way. There are so many examples that we work so with GOE and also my own research at Royal College of Art. We're looking at many different ways that the UN SDGs are addressed, right? So when we look at climate, we have a massive concern brewing or almost upon us already, right?
Yeah, for all of us.
For all of us.
Planetary, as you say. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. What does that mean? If I were to look at it at kind of a global level, I'm thinking, okay, so we have climate change, but when I bring it down to, let's say, India or Africa or Europe, or, you know, when I bring it down to a human scale where I can understand it, because when we think at a planetary level, it almost goes so abstract, so large, so overwhelming that we're not able to kind of grapple with it. And then we're like, okay, can't do anything. I'm just going to lie down and forget about it. Right. But when we start to bring it down to our neighbors, our community, our food. If I have to eat food in India, I need, you know, farmers to farm that food. These farmers in, say, India or Africa, they're largely, they're small shareholder farmers. Mm-hmm. These are not the big industrial farming techniques of, say, America, right? Mm-hmm.
Europe in the meantime.
Unfortunately, yes. Yeah. That's, you know, and India, unfortunately, is trying to move that way as well. But in the meantime, you know, more than 45% of the world's households depend on farming for their livelihood. It's an astronomical figure, you know, when you think about it. Now, what happens? So there's livelihood concerns, but there's also for upstream, there are people in Europe, in America, the upper echelons of the economic pyramid, let's say in India and all of these places, we're eating that food. Everyone has to eat. And so then we need food to be produced at a certain level of productivity to avoid a kind of a global starvation wave, right? And why do I worry about that? I worry about that because if there's climate change and a large part of some of the largest, most populated parts of the world are primarily small shareholder farmers who follow these very kind of traditional approaches, right? That are cyclical. They depend on seasons and times of years that's woven into the rituals and, you know, cultural practices. That's how farming is done. It's integrated into life. When those are disrupted simply by moving a season by 2 months, these practices are disrupted. The soil is eroded. You know, there's just maybe there's a drought or maybe there's too much rain. And so how do we ensure that these folks are able to understand and kind of respond together and collectively? And I feel like, again, here this is where AI and impact come together, right? Like social impact. I feel like we work with these folks, ISDA. They run a WhatsApp bot that they actually came up with. Like, they're able to map the soil of an entire region, and a lat long anywhere in Africa, they will give you data on what that soil composition is. What do you do with that data, right? And they're just one kind of organization that that cares about soil data. But then when you put them alongside some of these technologies, that data becomes incredibly precious because now we can, like, to where I'm standing, I can tell you, if I were in Africa, I can tell you, okay, what is the nitrogen composition or phosphorus composition in the soil? And if it's too high or too low, what do I need to do to address that so that the yield is good, you know, so that we're able to have a successful crop? What fertilizer do I need? And this is where I think these AI technologies running on a WhatsApp kind of platform, as evil as it may have been, it's still an accessible platform. So yes, you can get that data. You can ask it in your local language, Bhojpuri, Kannada, whatever that is, and get the best practices from across. And that comes from maybe Opportunity International is able to bring in organizations or virtual agronomers that ISDA has supported. So what I'm saying is it's the coming together of multiple types of organizations with their unique perspectives and resources that then we are able to stitch using these AI technologies and pull information and best practices and then present that back, package it and present it back to the people on the ground where it's most relevant. And now you can apply that to healthcare. You can apply that to, so, you know, you can apply that to emergency lines for refugees, you know, flooding into, let's say, a Tunisian border. Like, how do they speak to someone when they don't know the local languages there? So this N number of use cases that, you know, these kinds of, if used right.
I think this is a new universe for development and humanitarian workers, and our role as leading stakeholders is now to ensure that first all the people we are working with inside our own institutions and organizations are fit for purpose, and that they also learn how to apply these new technologies in a useful way. And Achana, when you think we have one prize of distinction, goes to Kenya, where we had a young scientist who did exactly about soil analysis with this solar panel that is very useful for also smallhold farmers in Kenya, because food security is the top issue of our time at the moment. We have more than 300 million of people who are starving, and the tendency is growing, and alone the conflict in the Strait of Hormuz might create another 30 million. So we are not avoiding at all that millions and millions of people on our planet have to live with all the impact that starvation has. But we can add something that helps us dealing better with it. It's not about avoiding and doing miracles. It is really about mitigating the phenomena that we are seeing. And this is, and I think it will be tons of work ahead of all of us to find practicable solutions and feasible things, because it's not only that 45% are small-scale farmers globally. I think half of the global population does not have access even to internet. That's right. Have to keep that in mind. And as you say, you are the technician, so maybe you can elaborate a little bit more. We are not talking only about connectivity solutions.
Yeah, I mean, in the way that we're not talking only connectivity solutions. There are many ways to kind of optimize, let's say, for very low bandwidth. And one of the things, one of our core principles at GUI has been, how do we keep abstracting out? And what does that actually mean from a technology perspective, right? And that means that, for example, whenever we think about AI, whether you're a technologist or not, the one thing that the messaging has done so far has to say, A, it's exploitative on data, and B, it's really exploitative on ecology, on the environment, right? How do we together as impact organizations such as CARE or as technology organizations like ours, how do we combat that? Because you mentioned this right at the start, Andrea, much of all of these kinds of technologies and innovations are now sitting in the US in the hands of billionaires. We don't want that. We don't want that. We need to break that kind of monolith. And then there's how do we break that together? As governments, as impact organizations, as artists, as people who care about the future, right? And one of the things we think a lot about is how do we, is there an ability for us to push on governments to, let's say, force companies, model makers, any of these folks, to kind of expose the ecological costs of their models? Because there is good models and bad models. So to your point, of it's not just connectivity. There's low connectivity, there's no connectivity, and there's high bandwidth connectivity. And all of these realities exist. Similarly, when we think of ecological costs, all of these bandwidths exist. All of these models exist. For example, I think some of the best, the greenest models, N-scale, that's located in the UK. Right? Their data centers are across the UK and EU, which is a great value. But not everyone knows to use that. They might use something that is far worse for the environment. So if we have, you know, like on food cans or boxes, we have ingredient labels and food labels. Similarly, if every model had to expose their ecological impact, then already people are being made aware and having then the ability to choose. Because now there are many kinds of models that exist in many parts of the world, right? And so I think that's... you know, really important. So when I think of, say, Grok's Colossus 2, these are mm-hmm. technical terms, mm-hmm. but it's just one of the AI models, right? This run by XAI. It's run 24/7. They run on, you know, 24/7, all day, all night, all week, all year. They run 47 turbines set up in Tennessee, mm-hmm. you know, that are running on LPG. Mm-hmm. This is incredibly bad mm-hmm. in multiple ways. It's bad for the people around them. It's bad for the environment, the planet. So, like, shouldn't we then shift to the N-scale option, you know, or mm-hmm. should we not shift to some other option? And I feel like this is one of the things that we keep pushing for. We put an ecological calculator on our interfaces so people can make that choice. You want to break the monolith. So one of the big problems of power accumulating in the hands of few is because then all the money is going there. Everyone is mm-hmm. using only their products. Break that. Let's break that. Let's make a platform that enables people to easily choose any model and swap between models. And it could be an open source model made in your country or a neighboring country that has the right values and ingredients to it versus the one sitting mm-hmm. Elsewhere. Right. I think these are the ways that so whenever I think of it, I think like globally, we should be able to vote with our money that we spend chatting with these AI models or using these AI models. We should be able to vote based on that. On things that are less destructive, mm-hmm. on models that are just less destructive. And that's what EU can do, really, is that they should. I write up a policy that requires all the companies to publish and then make it. So this is where the governments can really play a role. They can just, say, no, you cannot use models that don't publish their ecological impact cost. And that itself will make a significant difference.
And I really agree with what you said. But I think that this shows really that we, all of us, the global civil society, as hard it is to grapple with global aspects, we need more digital literacy. To take choices, we don't need only regulations. We also have to understand what we regulate. And I think this is one of the biggest obstacles at the moment in Europe, that many people want to regulate everything, but I'm not sure if everybody is totally aware what we are regulating and for the benefit of what, and how we ensure that our own people understand the differences of all that you explained now, because we know it's super exploitative when it comes to environmental impact. But there are so many solutions already there. They are already out there. We have to make sure in our governance model that those are included and that the awareness for this is more than complaining and saying, no, we can't do this, because this is all here to stay. It would be totally unrealistic to say, no, we turn away from technology. This is simply not possible. We have to make it digestible for us as human beings and for the planet we are living on, and we have to live on also for the next coming generations. So to end our highly interesting conversation, and I know that you are really rooted in art and history, so are the weavers that you talked about when you talked about your family, how do they express their interest to be part of all that? Why should they use technology if they use their ancient patterns, their ancient weaving technologies? What attracts them to it?
So I think there's both attraction and fear. Attraction for weavers in particular would come from livelihood sources, how to expand their livelihood. These are crafts which are dying. Many of the weavers I speak to, their next generation don't engage with these heritage craft practices because there's not enough of a income to be made. And so then, what has survived centuries literally is now going to be lost in the next couple of decades or so, right? So we have the real possibility of loss of some of the world's most precious heritage crafts and crafts practices and artisanal practices on one side, which would benefit tremendously from livelihood potential of connecting to urban centers where money exists and being able to share their work there or sell to these environments. There's fear. We're running, as part of my PhD work, I'm working with the state library systems across the state of Karnataka in southern India, and I'm working with media journalists, and these are illiterate women who are community voice journalists reporting from rural parts of North India. Why is my focus so much on rural? I started to think, and I'm like, okay, that's because folks there are not usually at the tables that several of us find ourselves at. How do we bring them in? It became very central, especially as I started to work on my PhD, which wants to engage with specifically with weavers. I needed to create a pathway to people like them living in the villages, low connectivity, no literacy, language barriers. Much of everything we see is English focused. That's leaving out a significant part of the world. And so how do we grapple with all of that? And as I've started to work with these groups, even in the very first encounters, we see so many concerns that we might not have thought of sitting far away. For example, when we talk to the rural media journalists, they're women, and women in northern India face a very high degree of patriarchy and all of that, the gender bias. And so they are not allowed, several of them, to even own devices, in the villages. And even if they are allowed to use them, they are allowed to use them under supervision only certain hours of the day. So there are the kinds of restrictions that we may not have considered. We may have considered language barriers, but we may not have considered that. There's fear, like a small rumor around, a rumor or fake news around how someone's profile was, misused online became a mechanism that prevented people from being part of programs like what we run. Young girls whose families were like, no, they cannot go anywhere near technology because it's just bad, you know. Mm-hmm. So there's all of these. So the fear is real. And with that fear, because they're not aware of, none of us are, but like there's real concern around these kinds of technology. Right, so I feel like there are these problematics that can only open up when we start working closely with them in co-developing and co-designing systems mm-hmm. that are best suited for their particular needs. We realize that women tend to ask farm related questions late at night after the children are asleep, mm-hmm. and they are actually a significant contributor to family farming practice. Similarly, in the weaving communities, women are weaving alongside men, and you know, so there's I think there's just a lot of possibilities that we have to look at when we develop policies, tools, infrastructure that need to include and bring to the table these kinds of concerns that we would never know of if we just sat far away to develop them. Sorry, you asked me something. Did I go away somewhere else?
No, that's fine, because I was thinking when you were talking now, I'm thinking these are also topics that we have to deal with in a highly developed city like Vienna. For instance, we have many people who are retired for 20 years, which is very good because the lifespan is expanding, who are not willing to do online banking. And we don't have many bank counters open for doing normal bank system things any longer, because 90% of the population is only dealing on an online way with the banks. So my stance is it's not necessary to go to a remote African place or to Northern India or I don't know where. These issues are global issues. And this is also a new thing to experience as a humanitarian and development worker. We are all struggling with the same things to a certain extent.
No, absolutely. In fact, we're working closely with the MasterCard Foundation very mm-hmm. much with these kinds of concerns in mind. My own parents are, very, very literate, but they're old, and there's a whole, my father just turned 90 this year and mother's 85. And so the banking concern is so real, because for them, there is also that vulnerability around financials that exist everywhere. My parents-in-law live in the US. We live here in London. You're right. To put it one way, Andrea, I think there is so much that we can learn from across borders. Mm-hmm. There are things. For example, India is leading with its digital public infrastructure projects. Yeah. When you think about Aadhaar and UPI, for better or worse, it's really leading there. And so some of the learnings from there would be excellent to use across, say, Europe or the US. Mm-hmm. Germany is leading with its privacy policies and governance, and that's critical. Like how they are doing it, we need to observe that. We need to, pull that into our own countries. When I think of UK, it's inherently a cosmopolitan country, right? And so you have some of the best text to speech, like I was saying, 11 labs, which enables the world to access information in their own language without literacy requirements. And that's grown out of right here, or DeepMind, for example, grown out of, here. And so I just think the Silicon Valley provides one perspective. This is the one that has become dominant today. But I do think, in fact, that a coalition of governments, organizations, and individuals across the world, whether that be Africa or India or Europe or UK, there is a way for us now to coalesce around these kinds of technologies and provide a nuanced kind of approach, a multi-perspective approach. And I think that's what I'm pushing for. I'm pushing, and I feel you, Andrea, I feel the urgency. And then we've got to do it. We've got to do it now. We are in we have to get together and make it happen.
And that's exactly what we are doing. That's exactly what we will do this September at the Ars Electronica Festival. I always had a strong appetite for finding and establishing and also funding such a platform. And that's a first step. This will not solve all the problems of the world. We are not naive. But at least if we could do 2 to 3, 4 concrete steps that really leverage better solutions, human-centered, planetary-centered, for the well-being of all of us, let's put it quite bluntly, then I would be very, very proud. Archana, thank you. This was an extremely interesting conversation, and I'm really looking forward to having many more discussions latest in September at the Ars Electronica Festival. Thanks for being my guest at the Care in Action podcast, Archana.
Oh, thank you for inviting me. It's such a pleasure, Andrea. And if I can leave our audiences with one thought, it is to say that, especially to artists, a call out to artists, but to every single person, right? We are here today and we have a lot of responsibility on our shoulders towards the planet. So this more than human approach to every creature, to the ecology, to all of that. And this is not the time for us to disengage. This is the time for us to engage. And we have to negotiate how our cultures, how our cultural memory, how our planet itself survives and goes on from here into the future. We're writing that now. We're writing the future of technology stack, right? The best part is all of us are learning. So this, don't approach this with fear, approach it with hope, and let's all engage. And yeah, thank you so much for having me. Thank you, Ars Electronica, for bringing us together.
And that's really a thoughtful thank you. This was a call to action that I couldn't underline more. So let's join forces. Let's take care together. And please don't forget to listen to our show also the next week. Thank you all. Thank you, Archana. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening. This was Care in Action, the podcast by Care Austria with Andrea Barstorff-Hager. For more information about Care and our projects, visit care.at. There you'll also find out how you can support our work. This podcast is made possible with the generous support of CC Real. Thank you for your commitment, which enables this series of conversations. See you next time.